My name's Vicky Neal, and I'm a mathematician at the University of Oxford. Since March 2021, I've also been having treatment, on and off, for a rare form of cancer. That's been very educational. I've been learning lots about cancer and the various treatments available. While I wish it was less personally relevant to me, I also find it fascinating. I take comfort and have great pride in knowing that I have colleagues in the mathematical community whose research helps to tackle cancer, from prevention through diagnosis to treatment. In this podcast series, Maths Plus Cancer, I'm going to sit down with some of them to find out more about their research and about the people behind the research. I'd love you to join me for our conversations to learn more about how mathematics and mathematicians are helping to combat cancer. I'm joined today by David Spiegelhalter, who is chair of the Winton Centre for Risk and Evidence Communication in Cambridge. David's career spans research in medical statistics and public understanding of risk. You might have heard him on BBC Radio or on his Risky Talk podcast, seen him on TV, whether a documentary or the BBC's Winter Wipeout show, or read his book, The Art of Statistics. Among his many awards and honours, he's been knighted for his work in medical statistics, he's a fellow of the Royal Society, and he's appeared on Desert Island Discs. David, thanks so much for joining me online today.
No, a pleasure,
In the context of cancer, I think that we, or at least I, turn to statistics hoping for solid facts and clear evidence. But of course, it's much more complicated than that. Why did you choose The Art of Statistics as the title for your book?
Oh, that's a good question. We took ages to choose the title. The whole thing was written, you know, finished off and everything, the cover designs and everything. I kept on changing my mind. And it was somebody else who suggested it because I was dithering around, you know, something to do with learning from data and everything. But the idea is the art is that it tries to communicate that statistics is not some algorithmic automatic process. Data does not give up its secrets easily. And there's a nice quote for I always use in the book, start the book with it, from Nate Silver from Signal and the Noise. And Nate, you know, works on sports betting and election forecasting and things like that. And he says something like, the numbers do not speak for themselves. We imbue them with meaning. And I think, you know, so it's an art. As a more, perhaps more of a craft that than to take data and to try to then say what can we learn from it. I mean, it's kind of the idea of turning information into knowledge or whatever, in statistical inference. But that sounds too narrow and too mathematical. And the whole point about the book is that this is not just a mathematical process. The sort of stuff that I've spent years both learning and teaching is only of limited relevance when it comes to actually using data in our real lives.
Yeah, I guess it's all about asking the right questions, not just kind of turning the handle to get answers out. If you ask the wrong questions, then you're going to end up with junk at the end of it.
Exactly. And the whole book is based around the data cycle, which starts with a question. You know, it's all to do with problem solving, with question answering. Starts with a question. And then, you know, then you go on to say, well, actually, you know, can we even answer it with the data we've got? But if you think you might, or you can plan then to get some data and collect it and sort it out and, you know, clean it up, wrangle it, and then do some analysis and then go on to the communication and the visualizations and the interpretation and so on. And the analysis is really only a small part of that whole thing. And yet it's what we all spend our time learning and teaching.
That's really interesting. And I guess in the context of cancer, ideas and tools from statistics and the statistical numbers themselves are used in lots of different ways in trying to understand and tackle cancer. What aspects are you most excited about at the moment?
See, well, I mean, traditionally, I've always worked as a medical statistician for decades. And I suppose, you know, medical statisticians are brought up on clinical trial data. And that's the most obvious way in which statistics have in the past been used, I think, for cancer to determine treatments and is staggeringly valuable to the idea of a randomized trial. So you have a proper control group that's randomly allocated so that any differences really, you know, should be, apart from the play of chance, which you get over by having lots of people, should be due to the treatment. You can actually quote a causal effect. And they've been enormously impressive in cancer, led to huge advances. And due to extraordinary, I don't know, courage of the people who've been involved in it. I mean, randomized trials of mastectomy and breast cancer and things like that, where women have volunteered to not know what treatment they were going to be getting up until the last minute. It's terribly impressive that people have volunteered for this and given huge knowledge to people. And that's, you know, I think this idea that, you know, the same thing happened with COVID, is that enormous number of volunteers for clinical trials. So, because everyone feels that if I'm going to have to go through this, I might as well, this, you know, what I experience should be of value to other people. So, so clinical trials have been enormously valuable in cancer treatments. But my main interest now is in prognostic models. And essentially what this means is that for people who have got cancer, trying to help them make a judgment about what treatment to have, and actually just to have an idea of what their prospects might be.
And I know that the Winton Centre, your team, have been involved in the PREDICT tools for breast and prostate cancers, which I think are designed to help clinicians have those conversations with patients about possible treatment scenarios and what the consequences might be for patients and so on. Those don't apply in my case, but I had a bit of a poke around the PREDICT breast tool because I was kind of curious how it works. So what principles were important when you and your colleagues were putting those tools together?
Well, the first thing is that we didn't do the statistical analysis. Paul Farrow really has been in charge of developing, and colleagues have been in charge of developing the statistical models, but it's the kind of thing I could do. The principles are to try to take factors that are available at the point at which a decision has to be made. Essentially, in breast cancer, about adjuvant treatment, and prostate cancer, about whether one's going to do essentially a radical intervention or not. Using just that information, using the best prognostic factors you can, to predict really essentially just what survival might be.
So in the case of the breast cancer tool, the clinician or the patient can enter data about the size of the tumour and a few kind of factors about the patient and explore the possible scenarios for various different types of drug treatment. Is that a kind of quick summary?
Yeah, exactly. So it would be, you know, obviously age and size of, you know, the number of nodes and involved and various things that one would normally be able to have available. And then looking at the survival if there was no treatment given apart from the initial surgery. And then on top of that would be the effect of chemotherapy, trastuzumab, and various other treatments that one might give in terms of survival. Using the best data that's currently available.
And one of the things that struck me as interesting is about that is that the tool presents this survival data in a number of different ways. So it's not just a single way. And I suspect that that's the result of a lot of discussion and thought about the advantages and disadvantages of different approaches.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing it doesn't do is say how long someone is going to live. It doesn't give any number at all. For how long? So, because I think those numbers are always grossly misleading to say, oh, how long have I got, doctor? Oh, a year or 18 months? Because the crucial thing is that we don't know. And actually, if you say someone a year, it's very unlikely they'll live a year. They'll, you know, more they live a lot less or considerably more. So it much more emphasizes the idea of the uncertainty, the fact that we could say, you know, about what proportion of women like you might be alive in 10 years, 5 years, 10 years, 15 years. And there's lots of different ways to present that data. Because there's no correct way of doing it, some people just like the numbers, some people like little icons, little images, although we've learned lots of things like don't use images of people and the choice of color is important. We're trying to make it as a sort of emotionally, we wanted it to be engaging and vivid, but not emotionally powerful. We want to be actually to de-emotionalize the whole thing, so we don't put great big black icons or great big red ones or anything like that, and we're not making a judgment about anything either. We use tables and bar charts. I like survival curves, and some people like survival curves, so we put them in there. Some like it, some can understand it. There's no correct way to do this, and so we do it in lots of ways. The other thing we're really keen on is that we never say this is your risk, this is the risk of the woman. It's not. Everyone's individual, everyone's unique. The most we can say is that, well, out of 100 people who ticked those boxes, essentially we're saying, this is what we'd expect to happen to them in 10 years' time. And we can base that on the data that we've got. And so that's how it's always represented. Because everyone's unique, there's always factors that we don't measure that the doctor might very well know about. And so it only provides a ballpark figure for the actual conversation to be had between the clinicians and the patient. And that's how it's used in multidisciplinary team meetings. It's there all the time. It really is, you know, like an expert system. We don't call it AI, but it is AI. It's treated like that. It's treated as an expert in the corner. They bash it through, see what predict says, and then they say, well, yeah, we think it might be a bit higher, a bit lower. This patient's got some extra factors involved. And that's how it should be used.
And do you have a sense of how widely used these tools are now? Have they been kind of taken up in lots of places?
Very roughly, predict for breast cancer is used around 30,000 times a month across the whole world. So that's about 1,000 times a day. Around the world. It's translated into 8 languages now, I think, and things like that. So it's seemed to be extremely valuable. And I can understand why, because it sort of levels the playing field. As I said, it doesn't say what the woman's risk is, but it gives everybody a common basis from which to work from. It gives a ballpark figure that puts things in perspective and gives an idea, and particularly what the benefit is of things like chemotherapy, which is going to be tough.
And one of the things I think is really interesting about it is that idea of empowering patients to be able to engage in that conversation with clinicians in a meaningful way. I know from my own experience as a patient, it's really hard because I'm not an expert in this stuff, but also I want to understand these decisions. I want to be part of these decisions. And I guess this provides a mechanism that clinicians can use as part of that conversation with patients.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the whole idea where we got, although it can be used just by the clinicians, our hope and our experience is that very often it's used with the patient as well. It can be used just by the patient if they've got the information. So it's completely publicly available. There's no patient version and clinician version. We rule that out immediately. Everyone gets the same. And so it should be part of that conversation, so a triangular conversation, so they can explore things. We haven't got side effects the side effects in prostate, not in breast yet. They're almost ready to go in. And I think that's also incredibly important.
Yeah, I'm sort of reflecting on my own experience. Side effects are really important in terms of making a decision, but it's so difficult to build into these things.
Otherwise, you'd just, everyone would go for maximum intervention. But no, you don't necessarily want to do that. So, I mean, talk from my experience. I've had prostate cancer, but I was diagnosed. It was 2016 or so. And I wish Prostate Predict had been available then. I really do. I could have put myself into it, got an idea, and it would have helped the conversation hugely, I think, with people. So I really, really wish I'd had it available.
So has that, your own experience, informed the way that you kind of go about thinking about these tools?
Yeah, hugely, yes. It's and my enthusiasm for these things. I think everyone should have these available for as many conditions as possible. We've now got it for transplantation and other conditions as well. So because when people see it, clinicians largely say, well, I want one of those for my cancer. I want one. I mean, they're not always so, you know, it's much so much easier when you, a terrible thing to say, but with the really common cancers, because you've got lots of data to build these things on. And so you can build more refined models. But the basic idea, I think, of it, you know, helping with the conversation, I think it is definitely to do with patient empowerment. Not, you know, patients can choose how much they want to be involved in their decision, but in the end, it is a shared decision. You know, it's the patient who has to take the consequences, and so they have to feel that they should feel that actually, whatever decision has been made, that they have been engaged in it. And you know, lots of studies have shown that this kind of thing doesn't actually change, may not change very much what anyone does. It's not intended to try to reduce or increase treatment or do anything like that, but it increases decision satisfaction when people feel they have been engaged, they have been consulted, their feelings have been taken into account. And this is hugely important because regret and, you know, is an important emotion that one would like to avoid.
And I think this interplay between the statistics and the humanity is such an interesting aspect of your work in this area.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I work with psychologists now almost exclusively, because this idea of the fact that, you know, these are difficult topics, people in a very vulnerable state, because this is for people just after they know about the diagnosis. So this is, as I know, you know, this is a really, you know, you're in an extraordinarily fragile state at that point. And so it's got to be done carefully. And it's got to be done with consideration and care. And yet it can, and but it can be done. And people really appreciate it. We've done so many interviews and focus groups and individual conversations with patients. I don't do them, but we've got trained people who are incredibly good at it. Yeah.
My sense is that there's an increasing emphasis on empowering patients to be involved in these conversations. Oh,
if you look at the Personalised Care Institute going on, Shared Decision, SDM, Shared Decision Making, it's been around for donkey's years, but it's being taken a lot more seriously. And the other thing, we've just prepared and published for the NHS 10 decision aids in a range of, they're actually paper-based at the moment, that's what patients wanted, but on a range of difficult topics, and which take the predict approach and play it out for topic after topic after topic, difficult things, in which one looks at, what are the options, what are the treatment options, what are the potential benefits and harms. It can't be so personalised because it's not, and I don't even like calling predict personalised, it's stratified. Because otherwise it sounds like it's your risk, it's not your risk. So it's stratified, I like that term. And the paper ones really have to be much more general, although they can obviously stratify into very broad factors. And they talk about the benefits, harms, relative treatments, and what you may want to think about, and particularly about the side effects and things like that, and what your prospects might be. So it's less refined, but it's got all that ethos there. And these things, again and again, are shown to be popular and useful, but they take a lot of time because you've got to test them, the language. We want to put in pictures. You tend to often have things at multiple levels. You have something at a very high level, then more detail, and then always give people sources. So if they want to go on the web and find out more, they always can. So there's no single way to do this. There's no single level that's right. So when you're catering for multiple audiences with multiple sophistication, multiple levels of numeracy, multiple interest and engagement, you have to allow for this. Yeah.
Well, one project I know you were involved with was to do with developing information provided to people when they're invited for breast screening to help them decide whether or not they want to do that. So I guess this is slightly different from the person who's just received a cancer diagnosis and is making treatment decisions. But maybe there are some similar principles there of, do I want to do this or not? What are the
advantages? Principles are exactly the same. And that was, I was on the committee that drew up the breast cancer screening leaflets. And in particular, this business of being clear that everything has got benefits and harms. And that was the first time, and that the information is not there to persuade you to do something. So that was the first time that a breast screening leaflet was published that didn't recommend breast screening.
I think that's such an interesting shift, isn't it? That change from, well, the medical people have decided this is what we think you should do, to here's the information to help you make a choice.
The policy is to offer breast screening. That's quite reasonable, but it's not the policy to persuade people to get breast screening. And so it was quite fairly clear about the benefits and harm, potential harms of breast screening. In particular, I mean, there's the multiple things with breast screening. There's the fact that you might get a false mammogram, and you describe how often that happens. But that's in a sense can be countered quite quickly through through further checks. But the biggest problem is overdiagnosis. And over treatment, because while the breast screening program estimated to save 1,300 deaths from breast cancer every year, it's at the cost of 4,000 women being treated unnecessarily for a cancer that would never have affected them. So that's the trade-off over the whole program. But at an individual level, you decide, well, is that the kind? Am I prepared to take that, to want to do that sort of trade-off? And some people will, and some people won't. So the crucial thing is that there's no right decision at the end of this. I've seen some very good articles written about somebody saying, well, I got two friends given exactly the same information, and they came to different decisions. They're in exactly the same situation, same information, different decisions. Yeah, absolutely fine.
And I read some of the work that read about some of the work that had gone into designing this leaflet about breast screening and so on. Has there been follow-up work to see what the impact has been on the number of people choosing to accept the invitation or turn down the invitation, or is it too soon to say?
Yeah, the numbers, they didn't go up, and I don't think they had a huge influence, actually, as far as I remember, the trend numbers in people actually screening. they held up well, but didn't go up. It wasn't intended, but.
So that ties in with what you were saying earlier, that often it doesn't make a difference to the decision.
It's an interesting thing, but it's not a performance indicator, because if it went up or went down is not the point. But as you said, the for me the really interesting thing was the fact that there was a focus group. It was a major sort of citizens' jury essentially was set up, which we went to address. I think it's about 25 women, really covering a wide range of within the age range that were being screened, but very different sorts of people. And we got to present to them, which is, I think, unusual. They had an oncologist there and a statistician there. And we were warned, about different ways to present the information. And we prepared all sorts of graphics and things like that. And we went and we were told you must not say which one you like, or that research suggests is the right one. You mustn't do that. You must just present these as we're thinking about these options, and then go away and leave these on the tables for the women. And so it was quite, we had to just do this. There's this. Here you are. And we left them on the tables. The women sat around and made their decisions, and they chose exactly the ones I wanted them to choose.
Oh, perfect.
I was so pleased. It's lovely. Just the ones. It was all to do with what does it mean for 100 people, blah, 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 and things like that. So again, it was what we would call technically an expected frequency representation. Nothing to do with probabilities or chances or rates and percentages. No, nothing to do with that. Just what does it mean for 100 people?
So this is the sort of diagram where maybe you have 100 stick figures and then they're coloured in according to
something like that. Or a sort of tree diagram showing you start with 100 people and this many go down different branches and things like that. So, and that research has shown that's a very good way to do it. But no matter what, but there's two things. There's the visual representation. But before that, there's this choice to do it in terms of an expected outcomes for a group of people. When you do it, is people say, oh, that's obvious. And you realize, oh, there's lots of other ways you could do it, which are not so clear at all.
Yeah.
You can start talking about false positive rates and stuff. Oh, no, no. Oh, no.
Yeah, I'm a mathematician. I'm highly numerate. I feel like I'm good at data. I really like these kind of frequency based diagrams. I just the ability to see the whole picture in one go in such an immediate way, I think, is really profound.
Exactly. You can do the part to whole comparison, especially if it's visualized than that. So it's not just it's concentrating on the bad events or the good events or something. You should be able to see them both. They should both be given equal emotional salience in terms of the color and the representation and things like that. So these are, it's all in a sense common sense, but it obviously hasn't been common sense all the time because a lot of communication has been.
I think this might be common sense with the benefit of hindsight.
Yeah, exactly. yeah, and a huge amount of work. Yeah,
absolutely. And related to this communication of risk, I suppose. Over the years, you've commented on lots of media stories of behaviours that do or don't apparently cause cancer. I mean, apparently conflicting responses on consecutive days and all of these kind of things. So I suppose as an audience, we have to have a questioning approach to such stories. But what advice do you give to journalists and researchers when they are telling such stories, which are sometimes built on important research? How do they go about communicating those ideas in a meaningful and accurate and not too alarmist way?
Yeah, I think we'd just say use both relative and absolute risks, so that most studies, the study designs that are used in a lot of medicine and a lot of reporting is in terms of what you call relative risks. What's the relative comparison between two groups of people? Say, given one treatment or another, you get one treatment, oh, that increases or decreases the mortality rate by 20%, or eating bacon increases your risk of bowel cancer by 20% or something like that. Lifetime. So it's done in terms of the change, the relative difference between. But it doesn't tell you actually, well, how big are those risks? Is it 20% of a lot or 20% of almost nothing? Because a 20% increase on almost nothing is still almost nothing. And you may not care a jot about it, particularly if they're telling you to give up your favorite food. So the only way to get an idea of the importance of something is to do the absolute risks. And it's not only us. I mean, everyone recommends this. It's guidelines in journals that are mainly ignored. that they should be reporting absolute risks, and in terms of what does it mean for 100 people. So, you know, we always do the thing, 20% increased risk of bowel cancer of your lifetime if you eat bacon every day. Well, you know, 6% of the population get bowel cancer. So that means that, you know, 6% goes up to about 7%. So that's that relative increase applied to an absolute number percentage. Best to call it 6 percentage points goes up to 7 percentage points. A bit like that. So that means that 100 people have to stuff their gob with bacon every day of their lives in order for one of them to get bowel cancer. And if they eat that every day of their life, they might not live long enough to get bowel cancer. So I tell this story with lots of images of little people and things like that. You can do it. It's a very powerful technique. Obviously, I tell it deliberately the other way to make it look a completely mundane and idiotic risk. Although, I've been influenced. I don't eat as much processed meat as I used to. For me, a bacon sandwich is a big treat. I used to stuff them down. So, you know, I do vote with my feet to some extent. But, you know, I try because, you know, it is a risk. I'd like my risk. That's why I take statins. You know, it makes a fairly small risk reasonably smaller, so why not do it? So so you should use absolute risk, and we've got a plug software, Real Risk, for journalists and press officers, where they can put in these relative risks, and it expresses in nice language and draws pictures of changes in absolute risks. What does it mean for 100 people?
I was really struck that you said these are kind of standard guidelines, and yet people are ignoring them. Do you think that's because they're not aware of the guidelines, or because they feel like they get a more dramatic story and a better chance of a headline with the big numbers for the relative risk? Or?
There's quite a lot of storytelling there. And I think I talk about this quite a lot. It goes right back to, I think, it often goes back to the scientists themselves, who quite like coverage and newspaper headlines. But then the press officers can want to milk the story. That's their job. And then the journalists want to get their story accepted by the editor. And then worst of all, even if they do quite well, it's the sub-editors who stick their headline on. And then it really, that's the most infuriating thing. When people have made an effort all the way through and some crass sub-editor sticks clickbait headline on that suggests that something's going to kill you. I mean, I see them all every day. I get sent these things. I don't know. Almost, you know, long for the days of COVID, when at least you weren't getting these cats cause cancer stories coming onto your emails every day.
I'm just going to interrupt briefly to let you know that if you're enjoying this episode of Maths Plus Cancer, then please do head to ox.ac.uk/cancer to find the other episodes in the series, in which my amazing guests tell us about some of the many intriguing ways in which maths and stats are helping us to understand and tackle cancer. True story. Early in my experience of being diagnosed with cancer, I knew there was something going on. I was waiting to find out exactly what. So of course I went and looked up the stats and, you know, there's sort of percentages describing the different kind of scenarios here. And then I thought, well, actually, this doesn't really mean anything, because either I do or I don't, or either it's this or it's that. There's no randomness in my case. There's no probability associated with this. It just is or it isn't. I just don't know. And at that moment, I thought, I'm sure I went to this talk by David Spiegelhalter in Cambridge where he was tossing a coin. And you will explain this much better than I do.
Now, basically, there's two forms of uncertainty, put very simply. You've got what you call, sometimes called aleatory uncertainty. I prefer to call it chance, which is before you toss the coin. You don't know what's going to happen in the future. The weather tomorrow and all these things, they're just unknowns. And we can't know them until they happen. We can talk about probabilities of the coin coming up a half, heads becoming up heads, whatever. And then you've got the other form of uncertainty, which is after you've tossed the coin, but you cover it up. So if I flip a coin now and I cover it up and I say heads or tails, what's the probability it's heads? Well, you know, it's either heads or tails. It is decided. And so what does it mean to talk about the probability? And I think it is meaningful to talk about the probability. It's what's called epistemic uncertainty. It's an idea dating back centuries that you could put probabilities on your lack of knowledge, essentially your ignorance. It's a number that expresses, you know, what we don't know. So that, as you said, when you're diagnosed, when you take a test, before you take a test for COVID, either you've got COVID or not, and you don't know whether the test's going to be positive. When you're waiting for a diagnostic test to come back, it's epistemic uncertainty. It's there or not, but you don't know what it is. And I'd say it is quite reasonable to think about what's the betting. You know, it's like when someone's pregnant, they don't know if it's a boy or a girl, all these things. It is reasonable. I mean, the main way to think about it, if it's something reasonable that someone might put a bet on, it's reasonable to talk about the probability. I doubt anyone was betting on your diagnosis, but mentally you are betting on your diagnosis. And so therefore it's reasonable to put odds on it or probabilities. And they're based on, maybe based on judgment and experience and things like that. And but eventually you will find out the truth.
Yeah, and I guess that ties in with what you were saying earlier about the distinction between with the predict tool, for example, being able to present kind of population level for 100 people like you type things versus a prediction for an individual person. The one person, whatever happens, happens, but you can say something meaningful and useful and informative about the population level.
Yeah, whatever happens. I mean, in the end, everything collapses down. It will happen. But the other way of thinking about it, I think, is that for this individual, their future is aleatory. It's his chance. Well, you know, we just don't know. We cannot know what's going to happen. But what we can say, in other words, we switch it to epistemic, you know, to a model of the past. We can say, well, in the past, or, you know, we would expect 100 people like you, this is what we would expect to happen in 100 years. So we're making a judgment about their chance from observation. I mean, that's how statistics works, of course. You know, it uses, you know, history to try to say something about the future. And it does this, in this case, by embedding that individual in an imaginary group of 100 people. It's not actually 100 people. We made that mistake. Can you imagine? People said, we got some response saying, well, we don't think much of this tool. It's only based on 100 people. I said, no. And that was our fault. Because, you know, we drew 100 people. We don't mean this is what actually happened to 100 people in the past. This is 100 fictitious people like you.
I'm imagining now, like on the BBC show Pointless, where they say we asked 100 people.
Yes,
it's,
yes.
It's not that you asked 100 people.
No, this is based on tens of thousands of people in their history. So that was our point, our thought. Until you listen to people, you don't realise how they might interpret something. I've learned so much from that. You kind of think, it never crossed our minds that anyone would think that. And yet, this was, you know, it was not just one or two. Yeah.
It's so interesting, isn't it? Those fine subtleties of the language.
And this kind of thing that when you've done it, nobody really realises it. They don't realise the care and work that goes into just the wording of a simple thing. Can I tell you a story?
Please do.
We did one on a really serious way for parents of children with congenital heart disease, talking about the mortality rates in different hospitals for congenital heart disease. And we published this. It's because it's public data, and it produced, you know, allowing for the variability and things like that. But, you know, when you start talking about, let's say 95% survival rate, you know, so 5 out of 100 babies like this, we would expect 5 to die. You know, how do you talk about, what's the word you put on that uncertainty? You can't say binomial variation or something like that, because we can put an interval around this. We can talk about, in a sense, what was the underlying risk for a child in that hospital if they had so many deaths. So you can't say, you can't call it random error. All these technical terms are so totally unacceptable. And you can't, for an individual, you can't call it, you know, chance or fate or providence, whether they are one of the ones who survive or die. We just know there's a probability. We don't know in your case which one it's going to be. What words can be? And we struggled for ages and then to somehow get a term for unavoidable unpredictability. You know, we cannot say whether you're going to be one of the 95 who survives or one of the 5 who dies. There's no more we can say. All we can say is one or the other will happen roughly in these proportions. There's unavoidable unpredictability. But that's a too clumsy a phrase. So, and somebody suggested, who wasn't even a native English speaker, suggested you could use, we can't predict who will live or die because of unforeseeable factors. And not unforeseen factors, unforeseeable factors. And it's true, actually, because a lot of it's to do with when the surgeon actually opens the baby up, you know, what they'll find, exact details, really fine morphology that could affect the operation. So it's unforeseeable whether the baby might survive the operation or not. So that went in there, and we checked it with the parents, and that was fine, and now that's in there. And it's a fact, I now always use that if I have to communicate to anybody. Say, well, why don't we know who's going to live after the city? Surely you've got good. I mean, why can't we tell unforeseeable factors?
That's so interesting. Finding that right phrase.
Finding the right phrase, not random error.
Definitely not random error. You've talked about the fact that these tools are not built on 100 people, but on tens of thousands of people. And I guess maybe one reason that the PREDICT tools were created for breast and prostate cancer first was that they are, sadly, common cancers, relatively speaking. I've been being treated for a rare type of cancer. So I look at these kind of tools and these data, and I have data envy, because there's not very much research and there's not very much data, because, I mean, happily, there are not very many people. But there are still statistical tools and techniques that are important in the context of small sets of data, sparse sets of data. I think I wondered whether you could say a little bit about that.
Well, I think what it does, it means that there's even more, I think, responsibility on the profession and the medical establishment to collect data on rarer conditions by, you know, synthesizing from, you can't just do it in a few centers or something like that. You have to make a really special effort to set up registries to collect that data, to inform, to provide everyone with a common baseline, so that when, you know, this occurs, wherever it occurs, you can refer to a wealth of experience. And you're not just reliant on who happens to write a paper about their group of patients, what they did or anything like that. So I think, because this is done, I'm not sure how much has been done with your condition, but it's an incredibly valuable thing to do. As, for example, in congenital heart disease, which is really terribly important, but fortunately not very common, and they've coordinated their data collection. They built a risk model for congenital heart disease. It's really rare stuff, but they've got a really quite sophisticated risk model now, because of essentially every single patient goes in. Every patient in the country goes in. So that's the way to do it, I think, that you have to set up these things. Because so even if something's rare, you do have sufficient, you have as much data as you could have. And again, everyone loves the idea of their experience contributing to future knowledge.
I absolutely, that really resonates with me. I have carefully ticked the, I want to be, please use my data for research. If I'm going to go through this, please do something with it.
Yeah, exactly. There's one, in a way, good thing can come out of all this, is if you can help people in the future.
I was reading a little bit recently about an area, I think, called experimental design, which seems to be about using interesting, I guess, kind of mathematical and statistical tools, maybe where you want to carry out a clinical trial, but you have very few patients potentially to be able to use, and how you can kind of control for those different factors you were describing earlier and so on. It seems like some interesting maths in there.
Yeah, well, I mean, experimental design has been around for donkey's years. It started really in Rothamsted with agricultural plots and, standard sort of Latin squares where you arrange your crops around the field so that everything's balanced and up to an element of randomness. And the simplest experimental design is a simple randomized trial where you essentially flip a coin to decide which treatment someone's going to get in two treatments. And that means that the two groups are comparable. Even in ways you don't know, they're still comparable because you've done it at random. You haven't matched them according to their characteristics. So they're matched even on things you don't know are important. That's the crucial thing about the randomization. But then that's a very blunt instrument, and it works, if you've got huge trials. With smaller studies, people are using increasingly adaptive studies, where you might start off, where you kind of, because if it's something's fairly rare, it means that, quite a big proportion of the people with the condition are being experimented on. And you'd like to minimize the number of people getting the inferior treatment. So the sort of adaptation that can happen is that you might, for example, start with a whole lot of with lots of different treatments, lots of different ideas, four different ones or something. And then you do so many, and then the one that starts dropping behind, at some point you drop it. So it's not going to, you've got a conclusion. And then you concentrate on the others. Or you change the randomization proportion. So more people start getting the one that looks better. The most extreme is play the winner, in which everyone, which is you just give the treatment to the thing that looks best at the moment. But that's a very extreme example. People usually keep some randomization going for as long as possible until you're pretty confident that it's good. So these study designs, which are aimed to, as I said, minimize the number of people getting the inferior treatment, a lot of work on that. You can do all sorts of simulations to work out how powerful they are to make sure you can get a firm conclusion at the end, and extensively used now. That's become very, very much more popular as a way to do it. The idea has been around for donkey's years, but it's taken quite a long time for it to become accepted because it was so much easier just to do 50-50 and keep going until you've done masses of them. And then, because there was quite a strong argument, I think, because people were doing studies that were too small, and so that they weren't convincing enough to change practice. And so some very influential people, led by Richard Peter, I think, had the idea that when you do a clinical trial, it should be the last clinical trial.
That's a really interesting phrase.
You do the last, so you make it enormous and you don't stop it early. You don't stop it until you're absolutely sure that it will change practice. And that's it. You never have to do this again. Because otherwise, people do lots of small ones. You put them together in a sort of what's called a meta-analysis and combine them. But actually, the blockbuster study, and there was a period of doing those. I think they're not quite so popular now because they established some really important treatments, to do streptokinase and aspirin, other things. So statins, it's quite a rare event, the heart attacks and strokes. So you've got to do a lot of people. So I'm really grateful I take statins, and I know that I have no idea whether they're going to help me or not, and I never will know whether they help me or not. But I know on average they reduce heart attacks or strokes.
And you know that thanks to a really robust clinical trial.
Thanks to tens of thousands of people with some really huge studies. Yeah.
You were a maths undergraduate here in Oxford. At what point did you decide to go into medical statistics?
Ah, that's a good story. Oh, well, I liked the pure maths, and I got about halfway through the second year, and frankly, I banged my head on my pure maths ceiling. I think everyone's got their ceiling of abstraction beyond which they really struggle, and I started struggling, and I thought I loved it, but it got really too difficult. And I was very fortunate. My tutor at Oxford was Adrian Smith, now president of the Royal Society, and a convinced Bayesian statistician. So not just a statistician, a Bayesian one. So he both got me interested in statistics, but also the philosophy of statistics, what it means. This idea of the uncertainty, the epistemic against the aleatory uncertainty. I was learning that 50 years ago when I was 19 and got totally indoctrinated about a particular way to think about probability, that if you give me a chance to, I will go on about for about 2 hours, so I'd be wary about asking me. So, what I found is that it was still very mathematical statistics, the sort of stuff I've been teaching as well. But then I got a job. I was interested in going into some more. I did a PhD again in mathematical statistics, no real applications. But then I got a job, and I thought I'd quite like to do some applications. My first job was in computer-aided diagnosis, essentially. In the 1970s, it was kind of AI in medicine. It was writing, working out algorithms for diagnosing patients and building prognostic models in head injury. So I was doing that in late 1970s, and that got me really interested in the whole business. But what I managed to do throughout most of my career was combine the more mathematical methodological work in with real applications. And so for me, the whole career has been an utter joy. And I always said, well, I'd do it even though I wasn't being paid. And now I found out that's true, because I don't get paid anymore and I'm still working just as hard.
You touched on this a little bit earlier. You talked about your own experience of prostate cancer. Can you say a bit more about how that's changed or not changed the way you go about your work?
Oh, my work. It's just given me a real enthusiasm for just what we were discussing, the empowerment of patients, the providing them with balanced information that's not trying to persuade them one way or another. And so they're not totally dependent on just the people around them, either family or friends or the particular doctors they see. Because one of the things we do, you always think somehow, it's like, people think, oh, science says, like there's some consensus in science. People think, oh, well, the doctors think that. Or something. And they don't realize that if they went to a different hospital, and maybe just a different clinic in the same hospital, they might get a very different opinion. There's a big variation from place to place and person to person. So the idea that there's a monolithic body of knowledge which decides this is the right thing to do is not the case. Actually, there is a big variety of opinion. I mean, that's why the multidisciplinary team meetings, the MDTs, are so valuable. And that's as I said, that's the point at which tools like Predict are enormously valuable at providing a level playing field across the country, if not the whole world. So, I think that for me, it's just given me an enthusiasm for empowering the patients who want to engage with the decisions being made about them. They may not want to, and that's completely their right. So, I'm sorry, thank you for telling me that. Like many will say, thank you for telling me this. You know, what do you think I should do? I'll do whatever you think is best. And that's totally fine. But that should not be the default. Otherwise, it's pure paternalism. So I think that, apart from it being, of course, a legal obligation to get a proper informed consent now, since the Montgomery judgment in Scotland in the Supreme Court. Do you know about the Montgomery judgment?
I do not.
A few years ago, and it was, and it's to do with the fact that consent, when someone consents for a medical intervention, it shouldn't be on the basis of the issues that are perceived by the medical profession. It should be on the basis that takes into account their own perceived anxieties and concerns. So it shifted the responsibility to the doctors to actually find out what's important for that patient, and not just to consider what the medical profession think is important. So it's given a big responsibility for that. So they
That's
have to. Then,
yeah.
Yeah, they're supposed to do it legally now to elicit this sort of thing. So it's almost made shared decision making or some aspect of that a legal requirement.
And so having the tools to do that is even more crucial. You mentioned multidisciplinary teams. I guess you have your own kind of multidisciplinary team. You mentioned you spend lots of time working with psychologists, for example, professionals with a range of expertise. How do you find those collaborations?
Oh, I love it. I love it. That's what I've done now for years since I had this more public engagement job. And now when we got the funding to do our Winton Centre, I'm the only statistician, essentially. So because we don't do data analysis apart from in the experiments we run. So it's a multidisciplinary team meeting of science communicators, of web designers and psychologists who are extraordinary. God, I love them. They're so brilliant. And they... You know, so we're both designing things, doing some beautiful design. We do use outside designers as well for some of it, for our things, but a lot of it is in-house designs, then testing them on individuals, and in the end, doing randomized trials. And the big difference between a medical randomized trial, you know, where you might spend, years to recruit a few hundred or a few thousand people. These trials, they spend ages to plan because like the good psychologists, they pre-register the design, they have to get ethics approval and things like that. And then you run them overnight. So, on 5,000 individuals also the number of different data places you can go to run these things. But people get about 50p a time and they do a study on which visualization they like, or do they understand? You give them something, can you answer questions about it? So you test people and you test their numeracy and things like that. So we've done workshops where we're designing different interventions with a group, running them overnight and coming back in the morning with the results of the randomized trial. So, I mean, you know, doctors, eat your heart out. This is the way to do it. So I'm so impressed with the people who can do this. Yeah.
We're going to have to wrap up soon. Final question for you. What advice would you give to somebody early in their studies now who has an interest in using statistics to understand, prevent or treat cancer?
Oh, do it. And we've only talked about a couple of ways. I mean, there's vast amounts more things. If you start getting into genomics, into genetics, and there's so many other ways in the development of treatments and so on. So many other ways. So we've only hardly scratched the surface on the role of quantitative methods in treating and exploring cancer. But I've always been personally interested in the real sort of, I think it's the kind of sharp end, the stuff that's dealing with patients, with humans. That's always been vivid for me, got me engaged. But there's a vast amount of battle with the science of cancer, all the understanding, the again, just trying to, which great industry of people doing this work. I've never found that quite as engaging. I like the pointy end. I like the human bit.
It's absolutely my privilege in this podcast series to be able to talk to people doing a whole bunch of these kind of quantitative techniques and
the
different
real stuff,
aspects of maths and stats applied to cancer. David, thank you so much for a fascinating conversation today, for all your statistical research, and also for being such an energetic and articulate champion of clear communication of risk and evidence to benefit cancer patients and so many more. Thank you.
No, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for letting me ramble on.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Maths Plus Cancer. I hope that you found the conversation as interesting as I did. There are more episodes of Maths Plus Cancer, as well as features about Oxford's research into cancer, at ox.ac.uk/cancer. If you're enjoying exploring how maths and stats help us to understand and tackle cancer, I'd love it if you'd tell your friends about the podcast. And please do join in on social media using the hashtag MathsPlusCancer. That's plus the word, not the mathematical symbol.